In the talk this evening, I'd like to talk more about mindfulness of breathing. We've been talking quite a bit about mindfulness already, and now I want to narrow in on the topic of mindfulness of breathing. You know, most of you probably know that this is kind of the premier meditation practice in the whole Vipassana lineage. Virtually every Vipassana teacher that I've ever practiced with has put it at the center of their instructions. And the Buddha put it pretty near the top of his instructions, which I'll get to in a minute. But also, it's the only meditation practice I know of that is shared in common among the three major meditative Buddhist traditions. That is Theravada, Tibetan, and Zen. All of us have this as a primary practice, and I don't know of any other meditation practice of which that can be said. So that says a lot for it. In terms of the Buddha's teachings, the Buddha didn't give that many meditation techniques. You know, I've read through 2,000 pages or more of his discourses in English translation, and there are not that many devoted to here's how you practice meditation. But the two that are most central for understanding mindfulness of breathing are the Discourse on the Foundations of Mindfulness, called the Satipatthana Sutta, which is found in the middle-length discourses, or Majjhima Nikaya, and then the Discourse on Mindfulness of Breathing, also found in the middle-length discourses, called the Anapanasati Sutta. Now, I know a lot of you don't have any interest in being Buddhist nerds, but I am going to offer some Buddhist nerd stuff along the way, because some of you are interested, and there aren't many places but the three-month course where you're going to get this stuff. So we're going to talk about the sutta names in Pali. We're going to talk about these collections of discourses in their Pali names, and then you hear it a few times, and it becomes familiar, and subversively, you become a Buddhist nerd. So we're sneaking it in. So in the Satipatthana discourse, the central discourse on the foundations of mindfulness, the foundation for Vipassana practice, has a clue to the meaning of mindfulness. The Buddha never comes out and defines it. You know, as Sally said the other night, if you asked around, we could probably come up with 100 different definitions of mindfulness. You look on the web, you can probably come up with a few dozen more. So when I look at the Satipatthana Sutta, which is the foundation for our practice, I find an interesting point, and I'd like to read you excerpts from that discourse that point to this, what I think is a central understanding. So there are four foundations the Buddha describes in that discourse. They are the body, feeling tone, which can be pleasant, unpleasant, or neither. It is the mind and mind states, the third foundation. And the fourth foundation is a little mysterious, called dhammas, but I think of it as sort of dhammic principles. So it's like mini dhammas in the fourth foundation. So let me read you some excerpts from all four foundations. Here's from the first foundation, when the Buddha is describing practicing mindfulness of the breath. Breathing in long, one knows I breathe in long. Breathing out long, one knows I breathe out long. Now this is the second foundation on feeling tone. When feeling a pleasant feeling, one knows I feel a pleasant feeling. When feeling an unpleasant feeling, one knows I feel an unpleasant feeling. This is the third foundation now. One knows a lustful mind to be lustful, and a mind without lust to be without lust. And now the fourth foundation. If sensual desire is present in one, one knows there is sensual desire in me. If sensual desire is not present in one, one knows there is no sensual desire in me. So having listened to those excerpts from all four foundations, is there one word that stands out that links them, that they have in common? What's that word?
Awareness.
Well, awareness is a general term. It's actually not in the translation.
One knows.
Knows, one knows. This word knows is really critical. The Pali word that's being translated is pajanati. Pajanati shares a root, is in common with the Pali term sampajanya, which is clear comprehension. So this word pajanati shows that something is being understood. And in fact, when Bhikkhu Bodhi translated this discourse, he translated pajanati as understands. Bhikkhu Anālayo translated it as knows. So this key word pajanati, which is used in all the instructions of mindfulness, means we understand what's happening to us. And this is what Sally was pointing to last night, also in her talk on Samasati. We know what's happening. We understand what's happening. So I'm going to suggest that we take this as our working definition for mindfulness. At least I do. And that is, mindfulness is knowing our present experience. That's it in brief. And then the PS to that would be, in the context of the Buddha's view of reality. So you notice this knowing is connected with the four foundations. The four foundations are the Buddha's own categories. So it's in relationship to these categories of experience. So I find this a really beautiful thing to understand from two points of view. One is, it's really simple, isn't it? To know what your present experience is. Let's say you're in the middle of a thought storm, and the thought train has been running for a while, and you've been, you know, to Bali and your home and your future work and your marriage, you know, relationship coming up, and then you come back into the meditation hall and you go, wow, where am I? Where have I been? All you have to do to get back is to notice what's happening. You can just ask, what's happening now? That restores mindfulness. It's so simple. What's happening now? And you take a look. The other thing that's beautiful about this approach is this word pajanati has understanding within it. You know, that was Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation related to sampajanya. And what that means is there's intelligence there. There's intelligence in mindfulness. It's a native intelligence that we all have. All human beings have it. And when we're mindful, we're manifesting it. This intelligence is the opening point of wisdom. This is how wisdom starts to develop in our practice, because it's an intrinsic part of mindfulness. And then it grows. Based on the properties that mindfulness brings along, the wisdom grows. But it's really right there in mindfulness. That's the start of wisdom. So it's amazing that something this simple, oh, I know what's happening right now. I'm breathing in. I'm breathing in long. My mind is full of lust. I know what's happening. It's so powerful. This is a section from the end of the Satipatthana Sutta. This is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of Nibbana, namely the four foundations of mindfulness. How does this simple thing do all that? So the first thing I'd kind of like to mention, there was this cartoon in the New Yorker that I thought was really quite insightful. And it's in three panels. So the first panel shows someone on their PC at work. They're sitting at a desk, working on their PC, typing away on the keyboard, but there's a thought bubble above their head, which is an image, and the image is they're out on the golf course playing a round of golf. So that kind of, you know, where they imagine themselves being. The next panel is they're out on the golf course playing a round of golf, But there's another thought bubble. And that thought bubble is they're at home making love to their partner. Second thought bubble. And then there's a third panel. The third panel is the person is at home making love to their partner, and the thought bubble is of being back in their office at their desk on the PC. This is kind of the opposite of be here now, right? It's be anywhere but here. And this is where our thoughts tend to take us, as Sally talked about also last night. They take us into past and future, places that we're not. And in doing that, you know, sometimes we call this, it's a distraction. You know, we hop on a thought train, and it's a little bit of a distraction, and, you know, we're not in the present moment, but some of the fantasies are kind of enjoyable, and, you know, it's not too bad. But I want to ask you to take a look. When you've been on a thought train, and then you come back, how's your mind? Is it calmer? More harmonious? More peaceful? More loving? More attuned to what's around you? Or is it agitated? Is it stirred up? Has that past and future thinking brought up uncomfortable emotions? You know, often going into the future, we might feel anxiety or desire. Often going into the past, we might feel grief at loss, or we might feel embarrassment about something we did. So these thought excursions open us up to really disturbing emotions. It's kind of the price we pay for not being in the present moment. So mindfulness undoes that. It keeps us here, and it prevents those. They're not just distracting, they're disturbing for the most part. The disturbing effects of wandering off. So this is something you can notice in your own experience when you come back from a thought excursion. What has the effect been? To calm or to stir up? You can check it out. So this is one of the things the Buddha called unwise attention. He said it's unwise attention when we give attention to things that are going to lead to more suffering. And it's wise attention when we give our attention to things that are going to lead to wholesome states of mind, beautiful states of mind. And mindfulness is one of those most beautiful, and it brings along other beautiful states with it. It's a very wholesome seed for other development. So this is mindfulness in general. And then within mindfulness in general, the Buddha identified the four foundations. The first one is mindfulness of the body. Mindfulness of the body as the foundation, really, for the Satipatthana. Also, in the numerical discourses, the Anguttara Nikaya, there's one point where there are 50 suttas in a row, 50 discourses in a row in praise of mindfulness of the body. That's a strong statement. So the Buddha really emphasized this. He said, when one thing is developed and cultivated, the body becomes tranquil, the mind becomes tranquil, extraneous thoughts subside, and all wholesome qualities that pertain to true knowledge reach fulfillment. What is that one thing? Mindfulness directed to the body. So really central to his message, mindfulness directed to the body. And this is really interesting because ultimately, meditation is all about the mind, right? The suffering qualities originate in the mind. The beautiful qualities originate in the mind. The hindrances are there. The enlightenment factors are there. The Brahmaviharas are there. They're all elements of the mind. And yet, the Buddha is really encouraging us to direct our attention to the body. Why is that? So the body has a number of really positive aspects in meditation. One of the things is it's always available. Mindfulness of the body can always be connected with. and it grounds our attention in a reality that's relatively firm. The Buddha once said that if you're going to identify with anything, that is, create a sense of self around anything, do it with the body rather than the mind, because the mind changes so much more quickly than the body. And you can get a sense of this. I think one of the reasons that sitting meditation is so powerful is that we take our seat, we don't move for long periods of time. It's not that it's wrong to move if you're in pain or getting sleepy, you may need to adjust the posture or stand up. It's not that it's wrong, but there is a virtue to having the body be still. And the virtue is that stillness of the body communicates a stillness to the mind. It's almost like the mind soaks up through osmosis the stillness of the body. Sometimes I've often felt in sitting, the body is there relatively like a rock, and the thoughts and emotions are just crashing, crashing, crashing. But the body is a rock that just stays steady. And over time, and it may be over years, that stillness communicates a sense of stillness to the mind. And it becomes a source of equanimity to us. And we have the sense we can sit through anything. We're not afraid of sitting through anything because we've done it so many times and we've come out the other side. One of my teachers in Thailand was Ajahn Buddhadasa, who was a great master from the 20th century. And he had a saying, don't do anything that takes you out of the body. He was a great scholar. He loved to study, a great meditator, loved the mind. He said, don't do anything that takes you out of the body. That's how important it is. And also being in touch with the body keeps us in touch with our emotional life. When a strong emotion comes, it will be felt in the body. Sometimes that's the first thing we notice. Oh, the body's feeling shaky. Maybe there's some anxiety. Oh, the body's feeling tight. Maybe there's some anger. Or the body's feeling really soft. Maybe there's relaxation in the mind. The body tells the truth, right? You know, there are books, The Body Doesn't Lie, The Body Keeps the Score, etc. It's becoming well known. We can use it to find out what's going on in the mind as well. It's very helpful that way. So within the mindfulness of the body comes mindfulness of breathing. In the Satipatthana discourse, mindfulness of the body is the first foundation. Within the first foundation, mindfulness of breathing is the first paragraph, is the first pointing. That's how central it was in the Buddha's teaching. The Buddha himself, this surprised me when I found this out. After he was enlightened, he still went into retreat. You know, and that could have just been because he was the administrator of a large and growing body of unruly bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. It's like, let me have some peace and quiet here. But he still went into retreat, and he came out of a 3-month retreat where he had practiced mindfulness of breathing for the whole thing. And he said, if anyone could say of anything that it is a noble dwelling, a divine dwelling, the Tathagata's dwelling, it is of concentration by mindfulness of breathing that one would rightly say this. That's high praise. If it was good enough for the Buddha, maybe it's good enough for us. So I want to talk about why breath can be a really useful focus. So I'm going to talk in praise of mindfulness of breathing. But I also want to point to some of the obstacles that can come up with it. So I don't want to sell it as the be-all and end-all in meditation. It's really good for some people. It's quite good for a lot of people, and it's not the best for a lot of people. So I want to talk about both the strengths and the some of the potential pitfalls in mindfulness of breathing. So why is it so useful? Number one, it happens by itself. Breath is part of the semi-autonomous system in the body, so it's always there. It's always happening, and we don't have to do anything to make it happen. So it's a focus that's always available to us. It takes care of itself. It is basically a kind of neutral object. Breath is not strongly pleasant, it's not strongly unpleasant. It has kind of a neutral feeling tone, so it's not objectionable, but we also don't develop a lot of desire for it. That helps keep the mind in balance. Although it's not intrinsically pleasurable to a high degree, it brings pleasure with the mindfulness of it. So the first thing we notice when we can be with the breath, we've stepped out of the disturbing thoughts. And in time we find, oh, that's kind of pleasant not to be bombarded by those thoughts and emotions. As we settle into the breathing, there's a sense of being able to relax more and more with it. So it does bring a sense of comfort and ease and some rest with it. And that has a certain pleasant feeling in the body. Once we discover the possibility for enjoying the breath as a focus, that enjoyment will bring us back to meditation more and more often. And that's a very helpful thing. To want to meditate is a wonderful opening. And one other thing is that this quality of pleasure, and the Pali term is sukha, is the proximate cause for concentration. As sukha, this feeling, develops in the body and mind, we become more contented. We're happy to rest there because it's pleasant, it's peaceful, and it's satisfying. So that's an opening for concentration. As we tune in to the rhythm of the breath, we let the rhythm be natural. There's something calming about the rhythm. There's something soothing in it. And you might just feel this for 5 seconds, but you can start to notice the breath has a soothing quality. That's part of its draw. That's part of its pleasure. And when I've done long retreats focused on the breath, what it reminds me of, the rhythm of the breath, and I may be making this up, but it's the image that came to mind, was being rocked at my mother's breast. And it was funny because Sally and I were in the San Francisco airport on our way here on Sunday, and we were sitting around at the airport, and there was this young couple with a young daughter with them. And I just watched them for a while because I didn't have a lot to do. And they seemed like a kind family. And for instance, the mother was often touching the daughter, just establishing that physical contact. And then the mother sat down, leaned back in her chair a little bit, and the daughter crawled into her lap and then put her head on the mother's shoulder and just kind of clung to her. The daughter was about 3, I'd say, so she was still small. And she could fit kind of on the mother's chest and her feet on the mother's legs. And her head was on her mother's chest and it was turned in my direction. The look on her face was one of absolute ease and comfort and trust. It was like there was nothing wrong in the whole universe for that little girl, because she was on her mother's chest and being held. It was really a beautiful thing to see. So that starts to come in, that sense of being rocked, being calmed, being soothed. The more we can let go of any attempt to control the breath, let the breath find its natural rhythm, and then that soothing quality starts to come through. In the beginning, that's hard to do. It's hard to be mindful of breathing and not control it a little bit. You know, like we find ourselves directing. Now breathe in. Now breathe out. Now breathe in. You may not say the words, but there's some intentionality often going on. That's okay. Don't worry about that. little bit of control in the beginning is not a problem. But as the meditation deepens, the more that can be let go of, the more the natural rhythm of the breath can come through, the more we can let go and just be rocked by that. Once we make a commitment to a certain focus in meditation, we know where we want to be when we are in the moment, that commitment really highlights when we're not there. So we'll know, oh, I wasn't with the breath for this period of time, means I was away in some distracting thoughts, images, etc. So the breath focus highlights the times we're not away, and so it provides a very clear reflection of how the mindfulness is doing or not doing. And we learn from that. We want to know when we're mindful and when we're not. And the breath focus really reflects that in a very skillful way. Breathing is a very elemental event. In the Buddha's language, one of the four elements is wind, the wind element. You could say air, the movement of air. Breath is all about the movement of air, which is nature, right? The air all around the planet, it's just part of nature. So an interesting question is, when does the air start being part of the planet and start being part of us? Right? We breathe it in, and there's a point at which, coming in through the nose or through the mouth, it kind of changes from being nature to being us, and then we breathe out, and then it's part of nature again. How far does it go in before it becomes us? How far does it go out before it's not us anymore? So we start to see that us and nature, which we normally think of as external, not self, are permeating each other all the time, going back and forth. So it has some interesting insights into not self. The boundaries are, to some extent, constructed, conceptual. Another interesting thing about the mindfulness of breathing, the Buddha says this also in the Anapanasati Sutta, it actually fulfills all four foundations. So it fulfills the body right away. That's where it's based. In the second foundation, in the Anapanasati Sutta, said, I shall breathe in or out, experiencing pleasure. There's the pleasant feeling tone of the second foundation. The third foundation, foundation of mind. In the Anapanasati Sutta, I shall breathe in or out, gladdening the mind. So there's the mind state of gladness arising through contact with the breath. Or the fourth foundation of the Dhammas, I shall breathe in or out, contemplating impermanence. Wisdom can arise based on the changing nature of the breath. Is there anything really solid there? When you look closely at the physical sensations of breathing, is there anything solid, or is it just like a ripple of tiny sensations, up and down, in and out, gone? So breathing lends itself to insight into impermanence. And I love this one. I shall breathe in or out, liberating the mind. Liberating the mind. Freedom in the practice of breathing, mindfully breathing. You know, it's kind of interesting. There's some new technology around these days to help train people in mindfulness of breathing. You know, it's become very secular, this whole breathing thing, very secular. And there's a company that has a headset, put it around your forehead, and it basically is an EEG machine, electroencephalogram. It measures your brain waves. And then there's an app that's on your phone that connects to the headset, and it will tell you how your brain waves are doing. So a friend of mine had one of these on loan from the manufacturer, and Sally and I were having dinner with them, and he offered to let me try it. I said, sure, you know, I like technology. So I put this thing on, and he revved up the app, and he said, okay, now be mindful. He said, be mindful for 5 minutes. He said, when you're mindful at a certain level, the app is going to make birds sing. That's the auditory feedback that tells you you're in some kind of a groove. So I started out, and there were not many birds, but I thought, I'm going to try mindfulness of breathing. So I went to my nose, where I've spent a lot of time in meditation, and I got very focused inside the nostrils. The birds really started going. And the birds just went on and on and on while I was in touch with the air moving in and out in my nostrils. And then at one point I thought, I'm going to try a kind of expansive awareness, you know, kind of like sounds. The birds shut right up. It was so interesting. So in a way, you know, I thought, well, it's really measuring concentration because I was still mindful. So I don't have 100% reliability of the app being what they say, but they definitely were onto something with those birds. So it could be a really useful training device for a particular kind of meditation, not the be-all and end-all, but it was a very interesting pointing that way. Okay, these are some of the beautiful things about mindfulness of breathing. Now I want to talk about some of the difficulties that can come, some of the obstacles. So the first thing to say is breath may not work for everyone as a primary focus. And I think we said that in the beginning, that's why we offered body posture and sounds as alternate anchors. Because for some people, the breath is not the right choice. And it doesn't mean you're a bad meditator or you're lacking in some essential quality for awakening. It doesn't mean that. It just means your particular system, the way it's constituted, some other focus will be more skillful for leading to your deepening. So that's no blame and no judgment on that. So one group of people that I see has trouble relating with the breath is people who have had asthma. If you've had asthma, especially as a child, and you've gone through that fear of not being able to get enough breath when you were young, paying attention to breath can trigger that kind of fear again and lead into panic. So that wouldn't be recommended if the reaction to focusing on breathing leads in that direction. It wouldn't be skillful. And there are other good focuses. Can also be if one has had an injury. If you've been in a car accident, for example, that left an impact in your chest, whether it's running into an airbag or running into a steering wheel or whatever, the memory of that injury, the trauma of that injury, can be triggered by placing the attention on the breath in the chest. And that also would be an indication, not the most skillful way to practice right now. There can be other sources of trauma also. You know, it could be childhood, it could be things that happened as an adult, and the focus on breathing could be triggering in that direction, and then it wouldn't be so helpful for calming. So if that's the case, then we offer other focuses. One is the whole body posture. You know, maybe the area that was subject to trauma recedes a little bit because the breath isn't being focused on there. But you can be with the sense of the whole body and sitting, and then you can really gain from that stability. The stillness comes into the mind from the stillness of the body. Or there may be a part of the body that isn't affected by the past trauma or illness or injury, and you can place your attention in that part of the body. I remember one of the Asian masters gave the instruction to one student whose mind was a little too restless. I just want you to be with the touch point of your seat in contact with the cushion. I want that to be your primary object for a long time. It did calm down the thinking mind. So there are lots of other ways to go forward. Then there are some particular mental reactions that come when we commit to focusing on breath. So I want to talk about four of them. They are striving, aversion to thoughts, judgment, and boredom. Sound familiar? Yeah. So, striving, really common. The way we use the word striving is it's the desire force, the force of wanting in the mind, when it gets connected to the field of meditation. So, for instance, you've had some really great retreats in the past, or in this retreat, you've had some very good experiences, say with the breath, but they've passed. And then what happens? I want them back. So we'll do anything in our power to try and make that old experience happen again. Or we'll pick up experiences that we've heard about from friends or read about in books or social media or whatever and say, well, that person had that experience. I think I want that one. And we'll try really hard to make that happen. So this is a fundamental difficulty. Because the breath can lead to states of calm and peace and pleasure, it very often happens that we develop lovely experiences in meditation through the breath, and then they go away, which they always will, and we really want them back. So we try hard to recreate that experience. But the trying hard is an acting out of desire. And when desire is there, we won't have peace and calm. Those are counter tendencies. All the good movements in meditation, all the good unfoldings, come from an acceptance of the present moment just the way it is. When we're dissatisfied with the present moment of our experience and we're trying to make it another way, we're in conflict. Reality is one way, our desire is another way. Guess who wins? Reality always wins. So, we have to learn to recognize striving and do as best as we can to let it go. So, some years ago, I went to Burma to practice for 6 weeks with a Sayadaw that I'd heard a lot of great things about. His name was Paok Sayadaw. He had a monastery in the southeast of the country. And he was a really respected master of both concentration and insight. He had very powerful systems for both. And I especially wanted to explore the concentration aspect with him. So I came to his monastery and met him. He knew I was coming. He'd heard that I was a teacher. He didn't know whether I was a good teacher or a bad teacher, so that was good. But he knew that I was a teacher, so he saw me every day for practice meetings, and I would report my experience to him. So I want to say a word about Paok Sayadaw. He was a wonderful being and a wonderful teacher. He was always kind. In every interaction I observed with him and students and other practitioners there, he was always very kind. He had kind of twinkly eyes. And there was nothing he loved more in my relationship with him than to hear a good report on my meditation. That's what made him happiest, when I came in and reported some degree of progress. So, we would have these practice meetings outdoors on his porch. Warm weather, you know, wasn't raining right then. And so I would be behind other people waiting to speak with him. So I would hear the practice reports and I'd hear, like, you know, this young Burmese monk say, oh, I just spent in the meditation hall yesterday. I was sitting for 3 hours in third jhana. And then I'd deliver my report, you know, which was not that. And because he knew I was a teacher, I felt like, you know, I wanted to at least for him to think I was reasonable. And so when I would go to sit, I'd notice this striving tendency come up. I wanted to experience something, you know, really positive that I could report to my teacher. And so I knew that I was striving. I could feel what was going on in my body. My body got tight. And so I went to him to report it because I thought, well, he will have a really good solution for my striving and really good advice for how to solve that. So I went and reported to him that I was striving for a particular experience, and his reply, don't do that. Okay. Okay. So I went back to my little kuti, and I had to learn by myself how not to do that. And what I saw was, you know, you've seen it probably a million times too, I was looking for a particular experience instead of just being with the breath the way it was. To be with the breath the way it is innocence, right? This is our innocent interest in being with the present moment exactly the way it is without trying to make it anything other. When I could do that, just come back in the present moment with that innocent mind, things unfolded beautifully and the deepening started to happen. When I was with the breath in order to get somewhere else, nothing would happen. Caught. So look at this in order to mind state. We aren't with the breath with that in order to motivation in the moment. We're with the breath partly out of an understanding that it leads to wholesome states, but in order for it to lead onward, we have to approach it with that innocence, openness, and acceptance. Then everything opens up for us. So this is the first thing, striving, because the breath can lead into pleasant experiences and we want them to happen again. Another thing that develops is we can develop an aversion to thinking. You know, we start to realize that we're with the breath except when we go off on these thought trains. And we might be gone a while. And while we're away on our thought trains, we're not developing the relationship with the breath. And I can't tell you how many times I've thought, oh my gosh, if it just weren't for these thoughts, I'd be doing great. And that can develop an attitude, they shouldn't be happening. If I'm meditating, I shouldn't be thinking. Because thinking is obviously what's causing the problem. That's a real bind, because none of us are going to stop thinking anytime soon. So if we think that we shouldn't be thinking, we're going to tie ourselves up in knots. Asaida Utejaniya says, you know, very directly, our practice is not to stop thinking. Thoughts aren't the problem. The problem is our not seeing them. Thoughts will continue to come. There's nothing we can do about that. If we get the idea they shouldn't be happening, we're going to try to suppress that energy, and that's going to bottle it up, and then eventually it's going to explode. So we have to remain open to the arising of thoughts, but the aim is to see them soon enough we don't get on the train. That's where the mindfulness plays this protective role. It's a guardian of our mind states. We don't take those trains because they eventually lead to more dukkha. So this is where that phrase Sally introduced last night comes in, not now. We see an appealing thought coming and we say not now. Joseph Goldstein has a very nice phrase, which is, nothing is worth thinking about. Take that to heart. Now, of course, that's in a certain context. If nothing was worth thinking about, we wouldn't have made it here for this retreat together. We had to think to get here. In the context of formal meditation practice, it's not worth thinking. Your most brilliant creative urges? Not now. Great insights that you want to explore further with long Dharma reflections? Not now. Any kind of thought that comes up, you can say, not now, for the purpose of mindfulness, for the development of mindfulness. There is a place for reflection in Dharma practice, for sure. There are times to reflect on the teachings and how they relate to our own experience. On retreat, I tend to do those reflections in the informal times, meal times, going for a walk after a meal, lying down before I go to sleep. And I tend to do them briefly. So I make sure to keep the thought on a short leash. Few reflections, come back. Check in with the breath, check in with the body. Because sometimes, you know, we think that if we think about a problem, for example, if we think about it long enough, we'll solve it. And meditation can look like a really good place to think objectively about our problems in the hopes that we solve them. I like this quote from Einstein. I'm sure you've heard it. We cannot solve our problems with the same level of thinking that created them. Basically, conceptual thought doesn't solve emotional problems. Where emotional problems get solved is from a deeper level of stillness. And then we take a new look at them. We see things in a new way. We're seeing with new eyes. We have a new view. So to get to that level of creativity, we need to let the mind still, let the conceptual mind still, drop into a deeper place of heart and mind and body that is more like our real home. And from that kind of place, the emotional problems can be seen in a new light and resolved or softened or let go or something. They don't get solved by thinking. The next area that becomes difficult with mindfulness of breathing is the problem of judging ourselves, self-judgment in relation to the meditation. It's very easy to think as we settle down for a period of connecting with the breath, I want to be with every breath this sitting. You know, and I'm going to try really hard. I'm not going to let one breath get away. I used to notice I had an anxiety in meditation around missing a breath, because I thought it was bad to miss one breath, and that was making me tight. And finally I understood that. I can't get every breath. So missing some is okay, and that helped me to relax. And then when thoughts take us away, we feel badly, A, that they take us away, and B, how long we were gone. You know, especially, oh, I'm such a crummy meditator, I was gone for so long. So we judge ourselves for not living up to a standard. So I want to ask you, what's the right amount of time to be gone? Do you know? Is it in your control at all? So, I mean, this is what's so silly about this kind of judgment. We're assuming that we're failing or falling short, and that means falling short of some standard. What standard? Has anybody ever told you how the right time to be away is? No, there's no answer to that. And then we feel badly, you know, we're only with a certain number of breaths in a row and we should have been with more. What's the right number of breaths in a row to be with? Has anybody ever told you that? No. But we judge ourselves for not measuring up to a standard that is entirely unarticulated. It's never been spoken. And yet we're convinced we're falling short. Oh, this is sad, you know? You all are here because you've gotten so much benefit from this meditation practice. You wouldn't have come and put in your 6 weeks or 3 months if you hadn't had a huge amount of benefit. So what that means is the meditation is working for all of you. All of you are successful just the way you are now. You're succeeding in the meditation. So you're succeeding here. Don't tell yourself you're failing. You're not. This retreat is going to be like your other retreats. You're going to succeed. You're going to learn a lot and grow in the Dharma. So, there's no possibility for failure with people who are committed the way you are, who have received the benefits the way you are. So, just don't believe those judging thoughts. You're making a good effort. Steve Armstrong has a nice saying. He says, make your best effort and let that be enough. It's a very good guideline. Okay, the last thing that comes in with the breath is boredom. Anybody ever experience boredom with the breath? Yeah, yeah. Because each breath looks suspiciously like the last one, doesn't it? Said, I've already been here 10,000 times today. What am I doing here again? So this is really common. A couple of things to say about boredom. Boredom is basically aversion to the neutral. So it's really important to see that because the breath is neutral, which is what makes it a good object, we will occasionally get averse to it because it's not enchanting us with desire. It's not terrifying us by being threatening. It's so right in the middle, it's like, who cares? So just to notice that, it's aversion to the neutral, so it's in the realm of aversive reaction. But the other component that's inherent in boredom, a little bit is not enough interest. Not enough interest. So the antidote is find a way to get more interested in your breath, in your breathing. And Sally suggested a couple this morning with the noting and the counting. Over the next couple of days, other teachers will be adding more so that you can really come to rely on what Dawn was talking about this spirit of gentle perseverance. Just keep coming back, you know, moment after moment, sit after sit, to the moment, keep coming back to the breath. May not be the most exciting object, but your relationship to it will deepen. And you will find things of interest in it. Again, we'll provide some specific techniques in the morning instructions to help with that. But there is always so much going on with one breath. Just look a little more closely. It means looking for more subtlety and looking for more detail. And this is part of a factor of investigation, which is one of the enlightenment factors that really will help support and encourage your meditation and bring in energy. We need to bring in an appreciation for the fact that we're breathing. So, these are some of the really beautiful qualities about being with mindfulness of breathing, and also some of the obstacles. You know, we will mostly hit those obstacles at some point in our practice if we go long enough. And I also want to mention one other thing. This is a quotation from Ajahn Suchito, who was the abbot of Chithurst Monastery in England for many years. He's an English bhikkhu with a good sense of humor. And he says that any time you commit to a technique, you are eventually going to run into craving. And that is really true with mindfulness of breathing. You will want it to be a certain way. And of course, craving is difficult. But we need to learn to work with it in the context of our meditation practice. So, just because there are these obstacles doesn't mean you should throw it out, unless there is something in your constitution that makes it not a suitable object, not the best object for your focus. In which case, there are other excellent objects. So, please talk to your teacher if breathing is bringing up particular difficulties as a focus, and your teacher can help you find something that just works better. And that's totally fine. So in the beginning, you know, we have to do this mindfulness stuff with a lot of prompting. We have to keep bringing our attention back and encouraging ourselves, come back and connect with the present moment. Over a long time, this habit develops a lot of momentum of being in the present moment, and there can be more and more of a sense of resting in the present moment and then opening to all our experience. We'll open up the instructions as we go over the next 10 days and move in that direction. And then you can have a sense of what Ajahn Sumedho calls an intuitive awareness. You trust in this awareness that is just able to know and respond to all the changing elements of our experience and still stay in balance and still stay peaceful. This will come. Close with a quote from the Buddha. Mindfulness of breathing is peaceful and sublime. It is an abiding in happiness that breaks up and calms unwholesome mental states whenever they arise. This is where we're heading. So at the end of the talks, we just like to sit in silence for a few moments and let the words settle. So thank you all very much for your care around the COVID protocols. And hopefully in another 12 hours, we can relax them and watch each other smile. That would be sweet. Okay, so we have about half an hour now for walking. And then at the last sitting of the day at 9, Greg will lead chanting again. And I really encourage you to come. It's a beautiful text that he's going to be teaching.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.